Back in Curaçao, we loaded a part cargo for Jamaica, and then through the Panama Canal to a place called Balboa. It was quite an interesting trip too. I'd never been through the Panama Canal before, and through parts of the canal, the ship is towed by like little railway engines, one each side of the canal, with ropes attached to the ship. They call them mules, I suppose, because of the work they do. I've got photographs of these mules pulling the ship through. So it was quite an experience. And we got through and we got rid of the last of our cargo in Balboa. Then the return journey, being pulled through the Panama Canal again with these mules. And so back to home base of Curaçao again. This time we loaded for West Africa. Went across the South Atlantic again, and we had part cargoes for each place: Dakar, Freetown, and Monrovia in Liberia. Then it was back across the big ocean of the Atlantic again to home base, good old Curaçao again. I got quite used to Curaçao. Been there that many times. It was an amazing place. Most of the white people were Dutch, and the locals, they spoke a peculiar language. I think they called it Papiamento. It was part Spanish, part Dutch, part English. It was like a bastard language mixed from a few other languages. And it was amazing to see them on Saturday night, these local people. They used to work all week, and then on Saturday night, like in most countries, they had their night out and went and had a few drinks and got a bit merry, and used to gathering in the square of the town there and getting a bit rough and restless. And the police, they had mounted police there, Dutchmen, on big horses there, and they used to have swords. They used to ride into the crowds there, pull their swords out of the scabbards, and they'd go swinging the sword side to side, each side of the horse, right into the crowd. Every time I seen this, I used to shut my eyes and expect to see heads rolling on the ground. But on the closer look, they used to hit people with the flat side of the sword, but still, it was very dicey. I always remember that. And then we loaded up, and where did we get orders for but Reykjavik, Iceland again. So I made a damn big order, and I went to see the captain to countersign it. He was sweating. I said, "Here we are, here we go again, Captain." He gave a bit of a sickly grin, and he kept saying, "Now you made sure we got plenty, have you? It's a long trip." I said, "Oh, I know it is. I know it is. Make sure you got plenty. There's no problem." Got letters there from Nina asking when we'd be home. She was a bit fed up with me being away, I think. So we done the long haul up to Reykjavik, and then after unloading there, we sailed south again for New Orleans. After the last time we'd been to the States, I'd made my mind up I wasn't going ashore at all. So I never even went down the bottom of the gangway. I stayed on the ship all the time we were in port. We loaded up again, and blow me if it wasn't another trip all the way up to Reykjavik. I was wondering how long we were going to be on this run to Reykjavik. Still, we'd done our trip. Had a bit of a rough passage up there on that trip. The sea was a bit bad and made the old tummy go a bit queasy. Well, from there we went back to Houston in Texas, back to Houston, at a place called Port Arthur. I stayed on board again, I wasn't going to be caught ashore again. And from there we loaded up and we went to Havana and Santiago in Cuba. I thought it was a very, very nice place, one of the nicest places I'd been to. I like Cuba. Everywhere you went, you could hear the rumba music playing. Oh, it was beautiful. And the captain arranges, we had a trip to the distillery where they made Bacardi rum. It was very interesting. And we got, I loaded up with plenty of Bacardi rum for the ship for the next voyage. And we also went for a trip to the tobacco factory where they made cigars. Now, Cuban cigars were very, very popular. Churchill used to like them. It was the only time I ever went to Cuba. I'd have liked to have gone there a few more times. After discharging our cargo there, we went back to dear old Curacao again, where we loaded for Rotterdam in Holland. So we set off across the Atlantic again, back to Europe, first time for a while. And we arrived in Rotterdam on the 3rd of August, 1949. And I signed off the ship there. I left the ship. The captain asked me if I'd stay on a bit longer, but I'd had letters from Nina wanting me back home, so I signed off the ship there. I'd been on that ship, the Lotorium, from 7th of March 1948 until the 4th of August 1949. That's 1 year and 5 months on a ship that originally I was only supposed to be going on for 6 weeks. It was a long 6 weeks, wasn't it? 1 year and 5 months. That was the longest spell I'd ever had in one ship. So I left the ship at Rotterdam. I had to call at London office on the way home to see the head superintendent to give him a report on how I had got on with Captain Edges after the trouble. So I had to tell him that I'd had no more problems and I'd got on very well with the captain after that. So he was pleased to hear that. And by this time I'd accrued quite a long leave. So I went from there to Cardiff to be with Nina and see her in a new home. I caught the train to Cardiff, and once there, never having been in Cardiff before or anywhere in Wales, really, I, not knowing my way about, I got a taxi take me out to the new address, which was in a district of Cardiff called Fairwater. It was right on the outskirts of the city, really on the outskirts. It was only a few minutes walk from the house and you went into the countryside, and a short walk took you to a well-known landmark, a cathedral called Llandaff Cathedral. We walked around that way quite a few times in the following weeks. I remember when he arrived there, it was quite a nice semi-detached house, built, I would say, in the late 1930s. See, in a really nice area, nice, quiet area, a garden back and front. It was really nice. So I thought everything would be all right. But when I arrived there, got into the house, I discovered that Nina's sister Peggy and her husband Herbert, they'd left and gone to live with his parents. I think it was his parents or some relatives in a part of Cardiff called Canton. And of course they'd taken all their furniture. So the house was very sparsely furnished, only a few things that her mother had, and Nina had bought a bed and a chest of drawers and a wardrobe for us. So it was quite a surprise to find the circumstances that Nina and her mother were living in. I think it affected Nina's mother quite badly as time went by. Anyway, before I go in any further, I just mention Nina and her family. I haven't said much about her up till now. Well, I was attracted to Nina because she was quite pretty, very pretty. And more, so she was very intelligent. She was. She'd passed all her school certificates and she would have gone on further in education had her father not died at such a time in 1943. There had been talk of her going to the Buchan School, which is quite a nice boarding school in the south of the Isle of Man in Castletown. So she missed out on that, but went to, had to go to school in Douglas, to the girls' high school, as it was called then, or secondary schools, as they called them at that time, the predecessors of comprehensive. So she had to go to school by train from Castletown to Douglas, and then walk from the railway station up to the school at the top of Douglas Town, then coming home had to walk that journey down to the railway station and catch the train home. So it was quite a long day for children in the country areas of the island at that time. We went to school, the secondary schools in Douglas. But to say, she was quite clever, Nina. And that was one of the things that attracted me to her. Now her father, he'd been born in Liverpool, Toxteth Park, in 1878. And he served in the Royal Navy, a time-serving seaman, which meant that in those days they'd done 22 years' service. And he'd served at the Battle of Jutland. He was a signalman, Royal Navy. Then when his time as service was ended in the Royal Navy, he joined the Coast Guard service and he got stationed at Castletown in the Isle of Man, and that's where Nina was born, at the Coast Guard houses in Castletown near the promenade, which is still standing today. But after suffering a couple of strokes, her father died in 1943. He'd been a very popular man, from what I gathered, different people who knew him. I had vague memories of talking to him way back in 1936 when I worked in the post office down in Castletown. He used to come up near the post office. There's a little square by the Castletown post office, just opposite the castle Russian. And alongside the post office, was the police station and the customs office. And I'm sure I remember Nina's father coming up and talking to the customs officer and the postmaster. But he'd been a very popular man from what I could gather. Now, our mother, Frances, she was born in 1896 at Ashington, Northumberland. I think that's the same place where Bobby Charlton and his brother Jackie Charlton were born. So she was a Geordie. Her father must have met her during his naval service up round that way. And her mother is still alive at the time of making this tape, which is 1995. So her mother is 94 at the time, 95 at the time of taping. But her father, from what Nina told me, her father done everything for her mother. He done the housework, the washing, done the shopping, decorating, even done the sewing. But that was quite believable because in those days, pre-war, lots of men at sea in the Royal Navy and the Merchant Navy, they had little sidelines. Some chaps used to, as a hobby, cut hair, became barbers, ship's barbers, which they all done for an extra few shillings, of course. And as I say, Nina's father, she told me, used to do quite a bit of sewing, alteration of uniforms and patching uniforms for them. He carried a sewing machine with him, so he made a bit of extra money that way. Oh yes, seamen in those days could knit. They used to knit and make socks and sweaters and embroider. A lot of men done embroidery, so her father was quite adaptable, as most seamen are. But he'd done everything for her mother, which in a way was spoiled her mother, because she was lost when he'd gone. When her father died, her mother was absolutely lost. Now, a brother John, he was the eldest of the family. He was born in 1918. And in the 1930s, mid-1930s, he joined the police service in the Isle of Man. I recall him when he was a police cadet. He's very tall, 6'3" or 6'4", I think, and very thin. But I knew him occasionally to talk to then when he was in the police service in the Isle of Man. And then when the war started, he got called up into the army, served in the army. I think he was in the military police. Then when the war finished, he resigned from the police service and stayed in the army. And he done his full army service, which was 22 years, and finished up as a sergeant, getting quite a good pension and a gratuity. He'd served out in Hong Kong and abroad in quite a few places. He had married a Scotch girl and they had two children, but they were divorced. Then after he finished his army service, John, our brother, he worked for the water board in Dover. And then he moved to Folkestone, where he died in about 1989, I think it was. Her sister Peggy was born the same year as me, in 1920. And during the war, she served in the ATS. And she married a soldier during their war service. He was a Welshman from Cardiff. Shepherd, his name was. And he died a few years ago. So Sister Peggy, she moved up to Coventry, where her son, she had a son and a daughter. Her daughter lived in Derby, and her son became a garden superintendent in Coventry. So she moved, after her husband died, Peggy moved to Coventry to be near her son. Nina had worked in the post office when they were living in the Isle of Man. Actually, that's how I come to meet her. On one of my leaves going around the post office to visit friends. And then when they moved to Cardiff, she worked in the general post office in Cardiff City. And there they were at this house in Fairwater when I turned up. I didn't like Cardiff at all. I found the people very clannish and not very welcoming to people from over the border. That's how I found it anyway. So anyway, Nina told me then that she wanted me to leave the sea and come and live ashore. It came as quite a shock when she asked me that, because I'd come to love the sea. I'd always wanted to go to sea when I was a little boy, and I loved it. It was such a great life. There was always new places to go to, new things to see, and it was a clean life. Everybody used to have two or three baths a day, or at least two. Everything on a ship had to be kept neat and tidy, so all your cabins and everywhere on board was neat, tidy and clean. It was a clean life, extremely clean life. Exciting, there's bad weather and one thing or another. As I say, new lands to visit. It was so wonderful, and I felt awful hard of giving it up. But she insisted. I went to the labour exchange in Cardiff, but there wasn't any work going. And of course, being an outsider, you weren't very welcome. They wanted jobs for the local boys. All they kept saying to me at the labour exchange, "You're stupid for leaving the sea. You should stay at sea. You've got a good job, a chief steward. You should stay at sea." And I kept thinking of this, because after the war, at this period of time, a lot of men had been at sea during the war and coming near the end of their, well, getting on a bit in their late 50s. And when the war finished, they left the sea. And that's how I got my quick promotion up to chief steward. A lot of men were leaving the sea after the war. So there were openings for promotion. Now at that time, at that precise time, I was the senior chief steward with the Shell tankers. The next promotion I would get would be a shore superintendent. They had the head superintendent in London, and then they had one at the on the Merseyside, Liverpool northwest area. There was another one up in the northeast area, and one down the west country, down Falmouth. So another couple of years and I would have had a shore job in the company as a shore superintendent with good money and a house provided. If I'm not mistaken, they had a car provided too at the time. And the pensioning age then for Shell staff was 55. So it was a lot to think of. But I couldn't divorce Nina. Couldn't think of it. So I had to sit down and think hard. And I thought back to the years at sea. the first voyage, being seasick so much, and people telling you all the different cures. Eat a green apple every day. Drink a pint of salt water every day. They were all guaranteed cures, people used to say, but it was just a kid you along. The war years, the times when things weren't too good, and the happy times, the crews on the different ships, and the fun. Ships being sunk, looking out each day, counting the number of ships in the convoy, see how many were missing. And then when the war came to an end and convoys were dispersed, no more convoys, used to wake up in the morning, look out, used to forget, go and look for the... And there'd be nothing but sea everywhere, all round you. It seemed as if the ship was lonely all of a sudden. All these things went through my mind. So I decided I would send my resignation to the company, which I did do. Then I got a letter back from them telling me to think twice. And as I had so much, I had quite a bit of leave outstanding due to me. They wouldn't accept any resignation until all my leave had been, my leave had expired, which was a couple of months. Some of the leave I'd already been paid for when I'd gone back early to take over a ship. So that was it. But I still couldn't come to like Cardiff. Because there was no going to be no chance of work there, I knew. I used to do the shopping for Nina when she was at work. I used to go with my ration cards to a little local shop there, and he was an awful nasty man there. I asked him for an egg, one egg. But he told me, oh no, you are on an emergency card. There are no eggs on emergency cards, and those stacks of eggs, cases of eggs in the shop. I knew what it was. It was just because I wasn't Welsh. Then a shipmate of mine from the Empire, McMahon, came to visit us for a few days. Jimmy Robertson, who is now an officer. I think he was second mate on a ship at that time. And we decided we'd go to have a drink in the pub along the road. So we went along and you could hear all the singing. Music all singing from this pub. We opened the door and walked in and walked to the bar, and I asked for two drinks. I forget what they were, but as soon as I asked for the drinks, all the singing stopped. You could have heard a pin drop. So we stood there and waiting for them to start singing, but they never sang again. We all whispered, talking together. So we said, oh, come on, it's not much fun just standing here. We left. We'd only gone a couple of yards down the road when the singing started again. It was just because we were English. Oh, I hated that atmosphere. It was awful. Yeah, I was getting fed up hanging about. Couldn't do anything. I couldn't take a job because I was still under contract to Shell Mex, because you signed a contract. I've still got that last contract, a 2-year contract, and they wouldn't give me my cards, my insurance cards, until that contract had expired, until me leave had all expired, so I couldn't take work. So I got fed up, and the house was getting a bit, wanted to paint outside, so I went and bought some paint, and I borrowed a ladder from the next door neighbours, and I started painting the house outside. Anyway, I got on, was getting on all right with it, and then this day I'd stopped and come down the ladder to, I must have to get a bit more paint or something, so I sat down and started rolling a cigarette. I was rolling my own cigarettes at the time. And Nina's mother came up quite aggressively to me and she said, "You don't do much around here, do you? Herbert was always doing things. That was Peggy's husband." She said, "All you're doing is sitting down." So something just snapped inside me. So I said to her, "Listen here," I said, "I don't like Cardiff and I don't like you. And I'm going upstairs, I'm going to pack my bags and I'm going off to the Isle of Man. And if Nina wants to come, she can come." So I took the ladder back to the people next door. I went upstairs and I packed her bag. So when Nina come home, I told her. I said, "I'm going back to the Isle of Man. I don't like it here. I've had enough. Are you going to come with me?" So she said, "No." I said, "All right." I said, "But I'll go to the Isle of Man and I'll see if I can find work. Will you come if I can find work?" So she said she would. So I left her and went and sat in the railway station till about 1 a.m, I think it was, before there was a train to Liverpool. Anyway, I set off and returned home to the island. So my sister Winnie got quite a surprise when I turned up. So I looked around the island in the paper for work, and went to the Labour Exchange. There was no jobs going. And at that time, work was very hard. It was the early 50s. There was a lot of unemployed in the Isle of Man at that time. And so the government, the Banks government, they started urging people who were unemployed to emigrate. There was film shows at the Picture House in Strand Street, Australia and Canada, for emigration. And quite a lot of my generation did, because there was nothing else, there was no work. After serving through the war and coming back, there was nothing. So a lot of my generation, as I say, emigrated. Anyway, I couldn't find anything. So I wrote to an old shipmate, Les Prattley. He'd been on the Empire Alliance with me. The yellow kid, as we called him at then, that time. He had left the sea, as I mentioned earlier, he'd got married. And he was living in Harrow, just outside London. Well, actually, place called Preston Roads was the station on the underground, and I wrote and asked him, was any work going down there? So he wrote me back and told me there was plenty of work around London, plenty of jobs going. He was working at a coal merchant's at the time. He was a clerk, clerical work. So I decided I'd go down there and see if I could find something. So I wrote and told Neil I was going down to London. So I'd spoken to quite a few friends back in the Isle of Man and told them what I was doing, and everyone told me what a fool I was to give up my position with Shell Max, the job I had and the future it held. There was a friend of Nina's, I forget her name now, from Ramsey, a fair girl with glasses. I met her and she told me too. She said, "Oh, you're a fool." Nevertheless, I set off for London. Now, I knew some people down in London. They lived at Kingsbury. I'd met them at my sister Winnie's during the war. George and Phyllis Bent, their name was. He worked for the music firm Boosey and Hawkes. I think it was almost, yes, Boosey and Hawkes. Now, what the reason he came to the Isle of Man for, he wasn't in the forces. There was nothing wrong with this fellow. How he got out of being in the forces, I'll never know. But they'd done sound apparatus for cinemas as well. And he came over, I'm not sure which of the cinemas it was. Something had gone wrong with the apparatus at the cinema. And he come over, overhauling them. And I think he'd done them all while he was here. He was here for quite a few weeks, a month or two. Real Cockneys they were. Anyway, I'd called at their home and stayed overnight a few times. Whenever I passed through London from one ship to another. And so I wrote and asked them, could I go and stay? Could they put me up? So they said yes. So I went there and I looked around. There was all sorts of labouring jobs. Nothing much at all, really. There was plenty of work, but labouring. How are they wanting men on the buses? London Transport. So I thought, well, blimey, I'll try this, you know, I'll give this a try. So I went for an interview and they offered me a job as a conductor. Well, all their drivers at that time, up to then, were always conductors taught to drive by London Transport. So you start off as a conductor, then after a year or two you're done training as a driver and then became a driver. Then I suppose if you wanted to go on, promotion became an inspector. But it seemed all right. I thought, I'll give this a go, you know. So I accepted the job. Then I wrote and told Nina and asked her, would she come to London to live? So she replied she would when I found somewhere to live. So this George and Phyllis Bent, George had a brother who was married and they'd bought a semi-detached house. It was a little close called Greenway Close. And it was halfway along the Edgware Road between Colindale and Burnt Oak. Colindale and Burnt Oak and Mill Hill. So they said we could have the front room as a bed sitter. So I wrote and told Nina and then she came there to live. So we moved in with this brother. I just forget his name, the brother's name. He was all right, but weren't too keen on his wife. Still, it was a start. So I started work, I went and done my training, got my uniform. Nina found work right away as a clerk, quite close by, not far from where we had this furnished room, with a firm called Frigidaire. Refrigerators and that sort of thing. Frigidaire. So she got a job as a filing clerk, I think it was, in their offices. So we started off, we'd both got a job. London Transport, of course, was quite a big concern and they're quite a fine training centre. I just forget where the training centre was, where I had to go. And was given a uniform. And of course the buses were all typical London buses, red. And at that time, of course, they were the older type with the, where the driver had a little tiny cab at front, sticking out at the front, which he had to climb up into, that type of bus. and the conductors had a punch machine strapped over their shoulder, a metal ticket punch, which had like a little thing sticking down the bottom. You held the ticket in the top and pulled it down and punched a hole in the ticket at the various stages that run the ticket. And there were quite a number of tickets. There must have been 17 or 18 at least different types of tickets, different price ranges, and they were held onto a wooden board, quite a long board, must have been a foot to 14 inches long, with very strong metal clips on, and the tickets right from the penny stages were all held onto this wooden effort with the spring clips. It was quite a big, heavy object to hold. You had to hold that in your left hand and take a ticket out and then punch it. And then, of course, you had a big money bag, big leather bag across the other shoulder with all the money went in. But it was very well organised and very strict rules. You had a hat, a peaked cap, which had to be worn at all times. I noticed a few years after I left, on buses, conductors never bothered wearing the hats, but when I was a conductor down in London, you had to wear the hat and inspect. If you weren't wearing it and an inspector come on, you were in for trouble. I was posted to Hendon Garage, which was quite away from where we were living, between Burnt Oak and Colindale. I had to get a bus along the Edgware Road. This cul-de-sac where we lived was the first little road off the main Edgware Road from London to Edgware. So I had to get a bus along the Edgware Road to West Hendon, and then another bus from there up to the garage. It was quite a way. But it was a nice little garage. They said it was one of the smallest garages in the service. And they had a very strict and proud way of running the garage there. There were trophies for depots which had the cleanest buses and the best service, and Hendon had won it a few times. Every bus, when it came in after its term of duty, was driven straight into a part of the garage where there was all metal tubes fitted up there, over, right over, I forget how many sets of tubes there were, with holes in, and you drove the bus into this contraption, and then the water was turned on, and the buses were all washed down outside, and as soon as they come out of the spraying area, they went on to another part of the garage, and then the women cleaners used to come and clean the inside. Oh yes, they were. Every garage, every bus was cleaned as soon as it entered the garage, and it went for its rest period, and then they were all spanking clean when they went out on service the next time. At the time I was working there, there were two brothers played cricket for Middlesex, Dennis and Leslie Compton. They were very famous. They played football for Arsenal too. Their father was one of the men in charge of the servicing of the buses at Hendon Garage at that time. And on a couple of times I'd seen both the brothers call in the garage to see their father. Now the services that ran from that garage were the 13s and the 113s, They went from Golders Green down to London Bridge. Then there was the 183s. They went from Golders Green to Pinner and Northwood. Both of them, quite long journeys. And then on Sundays, they ran a service, the 142s, from Cricklewood to Watford, Bushy and Watford. So those were the routes that served by Hendon Garage. When one started work there, you were what they called a spare man. That meant that you weren't put immediately onto a regular route. You were there in case of anyone who failed to turn up for work or chaps on holidays, and you were given their jobs, perhaps changed every day of the week. And sometimes you were sent out to other garages to work on buses on their routes. Quite often we were sent from Hendon to Cricklewood Garage, which was the next nearest London Transport garage in the area. I remember one such occasion, whilst I was a spare man and I was sent to Cricklewood Garage, with quite amusing circumstances turned out.